Okay, welcome along everyone. This is Open the Pod Bay Doors. It's our weekly deep dive into the Australian tech sector and startup sector. Brought to you, I'm Ian Gardner, I'm your host. I got a day job at Amazon Web Services, look after Innovation Bay, being an average investor, average entrepreneur, pretty much average at most things, to be honest. But I do love meeting people and talking to them about their background and career. So I'm delighted today to have Ed Husic with us, all the way from Canberra, kind of. Not really.
Yeah, but you can say it for this.
Yeah.
So it's all real once you say it on this podcast.
Yeah. But so now you are, for those that don't know, maybe just a bit of background, you are an MP.
Yes, I am. I'm the member for Chifley and Sydney's Western Suburbs, and I'm also the Shadow Minister for the Digital Economy and also the Future of Work.
Right. You are the future of work, or is that your role?
No, that's my role. Okay. I cannot say I'm the Matrix.
And how did you get into politics?
I'd always had an interest from my teen years because I'd always seen politics as a way of getting things done. Growing up in Western Sydney, it was a platform that you could definitely make some noise to affect change. And for me, it was just a journey in down that path. I'd sort of been set on it early on.
So, I mean, did you have a fairly standard upbringing in the Western Sydney? So
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely did. I mean, there was nothing, as I've previously said, remarkable about the type of upbringing I had because it was like what most people went through in my area. But I had some fairly feisty conversations around the dinner table, up against a very opinionated father and siblings. So you had to hold your own in that environment. And I guess it was a good training ground for where I ended up going. I was the other night at a forum about education and school funding reform, and it was packed with 200 teachers. And I said to them all, a lot of your colleagues used to throw me out of class for talking too much, and now I get to do it for a living. So it is good to be able to be in an environment where if there's something that you feel strongly about, you can speak up on it and potentially see some change come out of it. And that's been the good thing about going into public life.
Yeah. And your background before that, I mean, like, so you were born and bred here, but your parents came from overseas, is that right?
Yeah, my parents migrated in the late 60s from the former Yugoslavia. And they were really big, Ian, on education. And in fact, they're probably, when I think about my cousins, there's probably only a handful of us that actually got to university. I was the first in our family in a long while to actually go to uni. And so education was highly prized and I always had my parents pushing us to actually go as well as we could in terms of skilling ourselves up. So that's something that's really ingrained within me. And I had a mix of careers. I sort of spanning both the private and the public sector. What will come as a shock to many of your listeners is that as a Labor politician, before I was elected, was a union official. But it was in the
I thought they were all Scottish.
I have no accent. But believe in the fervour. But I was with the Communications, Electrical and Plumbing Union and covered a lot of employees in the communications space where, as I often describe it, you'd see sunrise and sunset. For people in the telco side, they could obviously, with the rollout of the national broadband network, see jobs and work as far as the eye can see. But for others in the postal sector that knew that, as broadband became more available, that would put pressure on postal volumes and ultimately lead to the, what we're seeing in there, which is a, steady decline in job security and people having to, think of new ways of working.
Okay. And, so what did you study at uni?
So I went to the, what was then called the University of Western Sydney and in a clever name change, they're now the Western Sydney University. And I studied Bachelor of Arts and Applied Communications. So I had initially thought I'd become a graphic designer and then I wanted to be a journalist. And then I thought, I'm just going to do this course and see what happens at the end of it. And I went into public affairs first, but then moved on relatively quickly into politics and then worked for unions and worked in the energy sector for about 5 years.
So did you dabble in the was that extracurricular at the time? So you had a job and then you'd go, at night to the union meetings or politicians?
Well, certainly. Politics meetings. So I started in terms of joining, I joined the Labor Party at 19. Okay. And I don't have to say my age right now, do I? People can work it out on the interwebs.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But anyhow, it was only a short time ago.
You're about 30, is that right?
Oh, can I come back to this podcast? What was I going to say? I went to Young Labor, like, you know, you get sort of most, I see it with people that are studying at that age, they'll be combining study and getting involved in Young Labor and politics and cut my teeth in, you know, some of the biggest political conferences that were in the Southern Hemisphere were New South Wales Young Labor conferences, and you had to hold your own. You know, you'd have people actively booing you or taunting you on the floor of a conference where there might be 600 to 800 delegates, and going to the floor of annual conference here that used to be held at Town Hall as well, you know, having to form your arguments, think on the spot, be able to move really quickly in a short space of time with what's allotted for speaking. You just had to – it was all really good training for where I eventually landed.
And is that what you wanted? So when you were 19 and standing on stage at these big conferences, did you think one day you wanted to be a politician and make a change?
Well, actually, no. I never saw myself at that early point getting into politics. I did want to be involved in some way, but it was in my mid-20s when I started, you know, ran for the first time for an internal pre-selection and lost. And then in 2003-04, I stood as a candidate for the Labor Party and wasn't successful in that election. And I just sort of dusted my hands and thought, okay, I tried. Now move on and do other things. Similar to a lot of the listeners of the podcast, they start their endeavours, they start their firms and enterprises, doesn't work out, move on to something else. I had the same sort of view. And then I was approached to run again, and getting a position as an MP, as I described to many people, was like stepping on the wrong end of a rake. It just hit me all of a sudden, and there I was. I was back in the political fray. And I guess what it did instill in me, and was a sort of recognition, you got a short space of time, use it as well as you can, get things done, and don't waste your time.
So this was 2010 when you won your seat for
Correct.
The first time.
Correct.
So you came in, government, you know, Labor was in power.
Yeah.
So you had, 3 years as a, you know, fairly junior backbench,
yeah.
but in power. So what was that like?
Well, we were thrown into it because we just had, you know, the first time where we had, you know, Kevin Rudd was deposed, and Julia was the new PM. It was a hung parliament. We had a resurgent opposition, and the atmosphere in that parliament that I went into in 2010 to 13, that was tough. There was no easing into the role. You had to learn really quickly and pick up the ropes in something that was completely new. You have no inkling when you go into federal parliament what it'll truly be like, and you had to learn quick. And someone that your listeners would be familiar with in Wyatt Roy, we were both elected at the same time in a series of firsts. He was the first, he was the youngest ever MP elected. I was the first MP of the Islamic faith to be elected, and we were also joined by Ken White, the first Indigenous lower house MP. And yeah, so it was a bit of a milestone term, that parliamentary
yeah.
term.
Okay, I don't want this really to turn into the politics podcast. So
this is your life podcast.
Yeah, we should probably talk about tech.
Let's do it.
So, and it must be, I don't know, 2 years ago, I think when Turnbull first got elected, I was going to call it elected, but, you know, put up to be the boss, there was basically a much renewed focus on the tech sector.
Yeah. And you know, much needed.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, and being vocal about it is good, but it does appear to have gone off the boil a bit. Mm. So do you want to give us your perspective on that? And, you know, without maybe getting too political on it, but just what's happening? Why is it important? What would you do?
Well, let me, before I even say anything, I am determined in your podcast not to be political. I don't want to, frankly, I know a lot of people listening get turned off by it. I'm not interested in playing those games. I like to involve myself in things, shock horror, that I'm interested in, and I'm deeply interested in the sector. I just know there are so many people across the country that have got a lot of talent and we need to deploy it in a way to actually build a better country, and not just in terms of generating a lot of wealth, but actually changing the way our country runs, way community operates. And there are a lot of people that are either starting their firms with their eye to building a better future for themselves financially, but also that want to change the way things are done. And I think we need to have an environment politically that supports that. And we had the prospect, and we did welcome the fact that the environment had changed, and that, you know, what had come to the fore was a focus across the political aisle on doing whatever we could to promote policies that would ensure that, you know, in terms of early stage innovation, startups, the tech sector, that it would start to blossom. And I had been sort of witnessing, and I said this last year, straight after the election, I thought that we would see a contraction in that focus, that it would start to dim. And at the time, there were people that were thinking I was being a bit of a narc or a pessimist. But surely enough, it did happen that, you know, you did see that ebbing of interest. And I think it's largely because there was within political spheres, a concern that they couldn't actually relate what was being done in the innovation space to the average person on the street, who was possessing a concern or anxiety that innovation equaled job loss. And while it will in some instances lead to that, it'll also create opportunity as well. And within politics, we've got to work out a way to actually build support around this.
Yeah. And so in terms of what's going on now, I mean, what's your observation as to what's working well and what we should be doing better? And that's probably as an ecosystem, and you can, you know, throw some, you know, Labour Party Ed Husic stuff into that if you want.
Well, so I'm basically doing my own stock take of how some of the initiatives that have been announced, for example, some of the changes to taxation laws to free up and draw in greater investor support. You know, we saw the changes to angel investment and the whole rules around VCs, particularly in terms of early stage. That's changed. I'll be interested to see how that's going. There's some signal or suggestion that it's not working as well as it could be. So that's an area of focus. Some of the changes to things like equity crowdfunding, which I've been critical of in the past, and people, if they're, you know, if they have an interest, they can see on the public record what I've said. But I will be interested to see how that pans out.
Yeah, I did read something this morning that it wasn't well received by the sector.
Yeah, and understandably so. I think, like, we have been genuine in our commitment to working with the government and saying to them, look, we know this is going to be tricky, right? And we want to give you the room to explore options on how to get this done. And we won't chip you for it, but just know we want to be kept in the loop, and we want some of our ideas. We want a chance to feed in some of our ideas and see where we can collaborate. And we previously had a very good – I certainly at an individual level had a very good working relationship with the former minister responsible, Bruce Bilson. And obviously Wyatt and I would talk on these things as well. But it did change quite a bit. And I think it's largely because as much as government talks about the fact that we have to embrace disruption, we're not willing to embrace it ourselves. And so within Treasury, I think there's a exceedingly reluctant mindset to embrace the idea that some things, e.g. corporations law, has to get a bit of a shake-up, and you have to look at new ways of raising capital that do not necessarily conform to the mindset of, you know, 50 shareholders and prospectuses and the way that you do things ordinarily. And I think that's an issue longer term. Regardless of whichever side of politics, I think this is a problem that we're not, as much as we also lecture about digital literacy, we don't necessarily see it on our side of the fence, and that's got to improve.
When you saw digital literacy, what, education, well, kids within, coding, that sort within, of stuff, you mean?
Within both the political, if I can say the political arena, within the parliamentary arena, but also within the public service as well, that,
right,
that people recognise that there is a whole lot of change being embraced within corporate Australia and within business circles, that, you know, you've got to, you know, apply technology and apply new ways of doing things much quicker,
yeah,
or you simply die. In in the, I think, as much as I have the deepest and hugest respect for the public sector, I think in policy terms, there are corners of the service where they just are very nervous and risk averse, understandably. You know, I can appreciate why. But the signals have to be sent from within the political arena that, you know, we need to embrace this. This is a reform mindset we need to embrace.
Yeah. So can I ask you about immigration? I mean, one of the few areas that has been an announcement, you know, I guess around this tech sector recently has been, you know, Turnbull piping up, you know, we're going to change the 457 visa rules and, you know, just make it a little bit harder. I mean, there's nuances within all that, but, you know, for us in the sector, that was just deeply disappointing and just seems astonishingly crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your view on that?
Well, I had a number of concerns. One is the haste with which the announcement was made. Two, the lack of consultation with people prior to the announcement being made. Three, the tardiness with which the government moved to actually correct some of the concerns. And four, for a government that is supposed to, particularly from the top down, be a lot more au fait and sensitive to the needs of the sector, you know, in terms of the tech sector and the startup sector, but you could, you know, potentially make it harder to get the talent and the skill required, you know, astounded me. You know, we've got a job to do. We've got a job in terms of skilling up local Australians to be able to meet the needs of the sector and businesses within the sector. But, you know, we cannot conceivably do this in a time frame that will meet the needs of the sector right now. So there's going to have to be some balance and we're going to need to bring some brains in. And the way that this has been managed and some of the, like, people have, you know, I've had, without naming them, you know, both large and smaller players saying to me, we can't believe how this has been managed and this is going to affect us seriously. I've certainly injected on my side of the political fence the fears and the concerns that have been raised. It's why we announced, Bill Shorten announced a few weeks ago, that we would bring in what we call the smart visa, which was this science, medical, academic, research and tech visa that would open it up more, particularly to meet the needs of the sector. And that was, you know, and there was, without giving away too much, yeah, there were a number of us within our camp that were saying we needed to broaden out what we were planning to ensure that we could get more and more skills that were necessary, needed by the tech sector to be available. So we've put that on the table. We're going to keep championing that and I'll keep raising it within Parliament because I just think we just can't abide by the current situation.
Yeah. Yeah. The first guest I had in the show, Daniel Petrie, was pretty visceral and vocal about this, just, you know, and he drew a comparison with Silicon Valley and the percentage of, you know, 50% foreign born. Yeah. And, you know, that's most of the wealth in this sector is coming from that generation. Yeah. So if you're smart and you can get into the country, you're going to generate wealth.
Mm.
You know, so it just seemed quite xenophobic and a very odd decision. So it's good to hear. So that announcement was made by
Bill announced that a few weeks ago and I can certainly you know, to coincide when you release the podcast, I can tweet the links to all that as well, or people can find it. But yeah, we did announce that. And I'm, if people that are listening have views, ideas, suggestions, please flick them to me because I'm definitely interested in hearing from people.
Yeah. So there's been a bit of focus around almost sectorizing the startup sector. So, you know, we've got fintech, you know, IoT is another one.
Med,
you know,
tech,
so there's a few ones that you can draw a circle around and say, look, that's a sector that's of interest. You know, ag tech's another big one that we've been seeing some focus on. Space tech, you know, my last guest was Andrea Boyd. I mean, there's now a sector emerging in that.
Actually, you've had an intimidating guest list. To follow all those people, I must say, Daniel, you had Elaine Stead, didn't you, as well?
She was hungover. You don't look too hungover, though.
No, I'm definitely not. But, you know, having to follow in their footsteps.
You're doing
not
well.
Easy. Not easy.
Well,
that's because your listeners can't see me sweating.
So, anyway, I mean, around that industry sector, I mean, is there one that you're particularly passionate about or more optimistic about or that we should be focused on as a country?
Frankly, no, like, if this may shock people, no, is my answer. And here's why. I certainly have said for a while that, You know, where we can apply the smarts, particularly within the tech sector and startup land, to our, you know, dominant sectors, you know, be it mining, be it in terms of agriculture, but also in terms of financial services, because Australia is seen as a player. There should be a natural alliance. That it, I never saw it as a binary. You must choose either or, like it's either mining or it's tech. When actually, it just doesn't work that way. And wherever people can find an opening, we should do it. And I'm conscious too. I don't want to signal as someone within the sort of political space a preference, because I think, you know, really it's not for government to be picking winners, but certainly doing what we can to have a conducive environment, you know, to have the policies in place that actually meet what's required. But it is, you know, you can obviously spend time within the fintech sector and be impressed with what's happening. Within ag tech, there's more and more of a focus there. And I always saw that, you know, if I can say what I have been very vocal on is promoting policies that will see the spread of startup communities beyond city borders, so within regional innovation. And there may be within there more of a focus on mining or agriculture, but you could see other players potentially emerge. I mean, this was the whole promise of both the internet and in terms of, you know, expanding our broadband network, is that opportunity would extend no matter that geography would no longer be the concern, that talent would find its way to the surface in a way that had previously been more difficult to achieve, simply because, you know, you just couldn't make the internet connections, just didn't work, and the opportunities weren't there. And that's all transformed. So I'd want to see more and more of that occur.
Yeah. Can I ask you about the, you know, state versus federal? So, I mean, every state government has got a position on innovation. You know, it strikes me that Victoria's got a big checkbook and Queensland's got, you know, some pretty entrepreneurial leaders. New South Wales pretty active too. Yep. So, you know, if you're a startup, should you be, you know, hopeful that the state government's going to solve the issues, or not the issues, but, you know, going to help the sector more than the federal government, or not?
Well, from my earliest points of interacting with the community, one of the things that stood out to me was, you know, we don't need a checkbook mentality by government in terms of just focusing on grants. So I'm really averse to coming up with policies that's just about grants. I just don't, you know, if there's a strategic way we can use government investment, I'm all for it, but I am not one for just, you know, doling out grant, you know, bringing out the sack of cash and divvying it all over the place. I'm just not interested in that. Startups had said to me, just do what government is supposed to do. You know, make sure we have the skills, free up the capital pathways, you know, find ways in which you can have startups engage in procurement, for instance, and have government as a buyer, so that we can then lever off that to go back into the corporates and say, look, we've been able to achieve, or we've been able to work with, you know, big clients like government and cut our teeth there, and you've got a lot more certainty and less risk in taking us on to, you know, provide services to you. So I've certainly been, more of that mindset, Ian. One of the things I really bridle against this whole state v state mentality, and I know
it does feel like an arms race.
I'm just not interested. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think that's a way. I describe it as sort of state of origin mentality, given that we're in New South Wales. But who cares? You know, like, it doesn't matter. You know, different sectors or different emphasis will emerge from different states based on the way in which people are organised on the ground. Let's just make it that anything that federal or state or local governments are doing that are impediments and inhibiting growth, let's see what we can do to remove those. Let's do it in a collaborative way. I know that there'll be some that want to, and I know Phil Daladakis may hear this and grit his teeth in a joking way. I know he's doing in leaps and bounds, you know, promoting Melbourne and Victoria as a great place, as is Leanne in Queensland. Victor Dominello's doing, work here in New South Wales, and a lot of people rate what's going on. Let's just, you know, if there's going to be any competitiveness, it's that as a country, We want to be a source, an attractor of talent, capital, you know, firms coming here saying this is the place to go, and that they have a smorgasbord of options. They can, you know, go to Melbourne, Sydney, you know, go to Brisbane, go to Perth, you know, Adelaide, you know, Hobart, even in Launceston, they're very keen in building their own startup community there. Yeah, so, you know, we see what's happening with Runway Geelong or Silicon Paddock, you know, that the whole nation is a massive magnet, a startup magnet.
I think that's the key. I mean, like in federal government, you can actually, you've got bigger levers to pull. I mean, you can set the framework for everyone to operate in.
Yep.
But if you're a state government and you're still, you know, trying to attract people and, you know, make your place, you know, look better than the other to a startup, you actually have fewer options available, you know, and a lot of them just do come down to cash. So, you know, I'm not saying I love what Victoria is doing, but it's been effective.
Yeah, absolutely. They've had some really high-profile wins, and you can see the activity there. And the I do like spending time with Melbourne with the sort of Melbourne startup community. But there is a cohesiveness, if I can say, about the community, and that they're all pitching in for each other. So. But having said that, and that's, please, I don't want people to interpret, oh, well, I'm sort of signaling out one city above another. Anytime you have an event, like, you know, we had Chris Bowen as the Shadow Treasurer speak about, from our point of view, reinvigorating the innovation debate in this country, and we held it at Stone and Chalk, and it was a massive turnout. And that's what I find. There's an enthusiasm and an energy within the community that, you know, you find in different parts of the country. They want to get involved. They want to see governments get involved. In a positive way, and I think that's fantastic and should be encouraged.
Yeah. Look, and, you know, I've got a sort of slightly unusual position in that, you know, I'm all – well, not unusual necessarily, but I'm all for the overall ecosystem, not a specific
– yeah.
You know, whether it's with my job at Amazon or Innovation Bay. I mean, we are – you know, it's national. You know, and our ultimate objective with both of these, and part of the reason I'm doing this podcast is, you know, we want a better and healthier ecosystem.
Hey, you're singing to the choir. I mean, I'm the same – I'm the same mindset.
Yeah. You know? So we're seeing, I mean, maybe just a touch on education. I mean, Mike Cannon-Brookes has talked about this a lot as, you know, there's too much focus on buzzwords, you know, incubators, startups, incentives, all the rest. But the focus really needs to be on education. Mm-hmm. You know, better educated kids, more tech savvy kids will lead to, you know, more startups, better startups. And, you know, and this isn't a short-term plan. This is a 5 to 20 year plan. Are we focused enough on that earlier stage education as a country?
I am concerned, you know, going back to something we touched on earlier about, you know, what's the state of play for innovation in this country and the way in which it occupies the public space, and by not having it talked about and valued, that that does influence not only business decisions about where they direct investment, but can also influence the decisions around the family dining table about what kids will do, you know, what they study, what they focus on. You know, the support of parents is important. If they think that it's a risky proposition going down a particular pathway, you know, do we stop opportunities being taken up? And I think the national dialogue on innovation is important because it transcends from a national level to the dining room level, you know, in this example. So it's really important. And I mentioned in terms of one of my shadow portfolio areas, I pushed for the addition of future of work because, you know, we know, you know, 3 out of 5 jobs, 13 out of 19 industry sectors will be, you know, fundamentally changed through the application of technology. Entry-level jobs will go. The skill requirements in the future will increase, not lessen. It's not the case that you could just, you know, take the easy path that, you know, oh, I'll be right. Once I leave school, I'll just, you know, lob into a job and I'll be, everything will be sweet. That's not going to happen to the same extent that it did in generations past. So we do need to emphasize that it's, you know, the pressure's on. We've got to skill up. And in my part of Western Sydney, you know, I'm often engaged in conversation with educators across the different sectors, or doing things like, for example, we're going to be, you know, announcing soon a major hackathon out in Western Sydney to try and start the process of, you know, getting young people enthused and giving them an outlet for their talent as well. We need to be doing more and more of that. I'm not saying that one hackathon will be the silver bullet, but we need to encourage more and more of these type of activities to get, you know, young people interested and then have the support there. And the STEM focus is important, but there are also a whole set of skills that we can be encouraging both in people who've found, you know, their jobs have gone and they need to go into new work, or people that are coming in. You know, like we talk often about how many people are needed for, you know, as web developers or UX or whatever. And we don't have, you know, we have a policy debate that's up there, up high, but needs to actually have a lot more breadth to it. And we're not doing it. And I think it's important for us to do, be it, you know, if it's within the sector itself by leaders like Mike, or within the political space, or within the community space. We all need to be talking this up more, and I don't think we're doing enough of it.
Yeah. Okay, so look, I've maybe got one or two more questions. So look, the next one's more just about what's next for you. I mean, we're sitting here in 2017. There's another year and a half before the next election. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm sure you're going to do what you can to get Labour back in power, and then you know, emerge as the next Malcolm Turnbull, certainly in that, you know, tech community. So, I mean, is that the plan then, you know, 5-10 years? I mean, how I'm just, it's confusing for me. I don't often talk to politicians. So, I mean, it's normal. Most startups just want to make money and change the world. Whereas, you know, your view of the world might be slightly different. So what's next?
Well, in the short term, it's, what I've always enjoyed doing is talking to people from, you know, all corners of the sector, you know, from the grassroots to the big fish, just getting a sense about, you know, where they see things headed, the trends, the issues that they're concerned about, the sort of dark edges of where they think policy or action isn't working and we need to see something happen. And I really do. I do enjoy talking widely, you know, and getting a sense of where people's heads are at. And so I'm in that space right now of just soaking in, you know, gathering the data, soaking in the ideas, and starting to then, in a way, in the longer term, leading into the election, developing our policies that we're going to put on the table come the next election. Underlying it is a concern I have about our preparedness on the future of work, not necessarily a tech anxious perspective. You know, sometimes, you know, what you see is people go from being excited about the potential of what tech can do in terms of changing lives to instantly flicking to an anxiety about, well, what'll this do for work? You know, and, we did release a few weeks ago, some of the work that had been undertaken by Fathom here, Mike Pritis, you know, looking at what, automation and technological change will do to sectors, you know, 40% of the jobs going in financial services, 50% in manufacturing, 90% in accommodation and things like fast food. You know, they provide entry-level jobs or bridging jobs for people between different, you know, careers.
Yeah, or trucking, taxis. I mean, there's a bunch of them.
Precisely. So one of the things I am concerned about is government has no – like, and this is, again, this is not a partisan comment. This is a generic government does not have a game plan.
Yeah.
And – you know, when I get, Ian, you know, a venture capitalist and a senior union official both saying, what are we doing about the future of work? You know, and they're in different spaces at different times, but saying the same thing, that's one thing that I think a lot about. And, you know, getting ready for that is a big challenge. And there's no easy answer to it. It's going to take a multi-level response. But we do need to get a sense of urgency about that, because if that does happen and it happens quickly, like it may happen gradually and we may accommodate it. It's been happening since the industrial, you know, revolution itself. So let's not freak out too much about it. But we do need to prepare. We do need to get a much bigger sense of urgency about it. So, you know, when you ask me about what I'm thinking longer term or in the immediate term of leading up to the next election, getting us prepared for that is probably one of my big deep within, that's a big priority for me.
Okay, that's good to hear. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
With that. I think I did send you these in advance, but I normally ask my guests a few top tips for the listeners in terms of recommendations. So, and if you haven't prepared, don't worry, this is a good chance to get put in the spot. So any book recommendations? What would you suggest we read?
Oh, wow. So my head has been so stuck at the moment in just, you know, because we just come out of the budget, and so you read a lot there. And it's so not, it's not seen like, no, no, I am not recommending, dear listener, anyone reading any budget paper. Don't do it to yourself. I'll do it. I'll take it. I'll do that for you. You know, in the last 12 months in particular, you know, Martin Ford's Rise of the Robots, because Daniel Petrie has been saying, telling anyone who'd listen, you know, read this book, read this book.
He also said Sapiens. You read that?
No, I haven't. But Tim Dunlop Workless, an Australian author on future of work, is definitely worth a read. Particularly, I think the debate around UBI in terms of basic income is emerging more and more, and you're having different schools of thought. I mean, Dunlop pushes this a lot in his work. That's been something that that definitely did was worth a read. In terms of a lot of people, I mean, there are other things that I've read recently that I don't think necessarily your listeners would plough through, but during my holiday break, back in January, read the book on Keating by Troy Bramston. And the only reason I mention it is because I'm often thinking of the parallels of, you know, what they had to do back in the 80s, 90s to reform the economy and open it up to what we're presented with now in a similar sense, and where I think government had a lot more influence back then to shape reform. This is now being driven by what we're seeing within the sector. The sector's challenging a lot of the long-held views about regulation and law and the way we organise ourselves. And having a reformist, I hate using this term narrative because everyone talks about narrative, but having the reformist narrative, being able to explain to people that we have to go through this, but we're going to look after people on the way through, shaping that and having that in a way that is readily digestible and people can go, yep, I'm for that. Those type of books are very influential.
Okay. Podcast, do you listen to podcasts?
I listen quite a lot to Note to Self, the podcast talking about tech change. Like sometimes put that on as I'm driving to Canberra. Because that's what I do. Like in terms of, we got the parliamentary sittings coming up now, and I'll listen to that. I haven't listened lately, but was really good, I've enjoyed quite a lot.
Okay, favorite news source. I mean, I'm sure as a politician, you're an avid news junkie.
Can I say I have really enjoyed? So obviously you day to day, you listen to, you know, a whole range of, from ABC to Sky, and there's a whole stack of local news sources. But, you know, appreciating Apple News and the curation, you know, and the way that provides breadth. Financial Times I read quite a bit because I like their focus. It's not the sort of turgid, just reading of what's happening in the markets, but rather they do focus a lot on tech within FT, and I like their analysis. It's very thoughtful. It's very considered, and I definitely recommend the
Economist. Do you read The Economist?
Yeah, The Economist is not as much as FT, but articles will crop up from time to time within The Economist that take your eye.
Have you got a favorite app? Like, what's in the homepage of your phone?
You know what? I was reading in the Financial Review. This was ages ago. Would have been around this movement to make sure that software developers don't keep focusing on constant engagement, and people always keeping an eye on their notifications and being distracted, like the distraction that causes. So they're saying, when you're doing this, like, let's not reward that distraction. And so what I did earlier in the year is I used to have page after page on my iPhone of apps, and I've just consolidated it, and I've locked down the notifications as well as a result of that. I wish I could find – I'll have to find who's leading that within Silicon Valley. It's emerged out of Silicon Valley where they're trying to get people to change the mindset.
Interesting.
When you ask me about my apps – I have sort of consolidated, got rid of a lot of, reduced the notification frequency, and
And more often than not, it's social media as a politician, because it's really redefined the way politicians engage with the broader public. Yep. And so, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, seeing what's happening with Instagram and the battle between Instagram and Snapchat has been interesting as well. Because stories have on Instagram have, I think, are really starting to crush Snapchat's.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's changing.
No, I agree.
So, yeah.
Favorite, have you got a TV show? Have you got time to watch TV? What do you do when you've got a glass of wine and, or maybe not a glass of wine, but sitting at home?
You know, I was a massive fan of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And I love asking people in the States if they watch it, and they say, no, it's too close to home. So that's been fun. Went through Billions. I binge watched Billions, the HBO show.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard it's great.
Oh, you got to watch it. It is. I tell you, once you start, you don't stop. And it is top viewing. So Billions has been up there. Blacklist has been recommended to me. I haven't watched. I haven't started yet.
One of my other guests recommended that.
Yeah. Master of None I enjoyed on Netflix has been really good. So, yeah, they've been – like if you get a chance – in my space, because I'm on the go, it's really a sort of late Friday night, or if you've got a rare Saturday night where you can, then that's – if you can put up the feet, that's good.
Yeah, cool. All right, look, we'll maybe call it a day there, Ed.
But
thank you so much for coming along and sparing an hour of your time. And thank you, dear listener, for tuning in thus far. I hope you're enjoying it. If you've got any feedback on – what you're hearing, who you'd want to hear, how we could do it better, just please let us know. All right, we'll see you next time.